Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Bustin' Loose Baseball, hosted by Grant Paulson and Toby Altizer, gives you in-depth analytics and interviews on everything baseball in the nation's capital. Now, here's your host, Grant Paulson and Toby Altizer.
Bustin' Loose Baseball, Toby Altizer with you. Grant Paulson off on vacation, so we'll have a new episode with him coming up in just a little bit. Producer Darris Dameron alongside. Appreciate you checking us out. This is your first time listening to the podcast. Appreciate you listening. Make sure you like and subscribe to all the podcasty things. Got a great episode for you. A couple of interviews you'll hear. Spencer Nussbaum of The Athletic joined Grant and Danny and had an interesting conversation with about C.J. Abrams moving to second base. That's been a lot of the discussion around this team recently. And his move to second base, we still haven't seen him play there. I want to talk a little bit more about that in just a couple of moments. Also, Simon Matthews, the pitching coach of the Nationals, joined Grant and Danny. You'll hear that conversation as well as he talked about Cade Cavalli and what he's been able to accomplish in his last couple of starts and the way that he's grown throughout the season. So you hear that conversation in just a bit as well. But let's start with C.J. Abrams, because I think that's the main story right now around the Nationals. C.J. Abrams moving from shortstop to second base. This isn't something that was found out by a tip or a report or anything. This is something that Blake Butera came out and said in a pregame presser before the New York Mets series, and it was a little bit shocking in terms of timing. I think just laying this out, and I don't want to speak for Grant necessarily, but he's kind of said this for whenever we've talked about it. He said it on air as well on 106.7 The Fan. You know, this is something that the move itself is not shocking and is the correct move. I think for me, though, the weird part is the timing. You know, I don't have an issue moving a guy who's leading all major league shortstops in errors and has first percentile fielding run value off of one of the most premium positions on the field. I mean, shortstop, center field, those are the two most premium positions on the field. Catcher, I guess you could say to an extent as well. But, you know, up the middle, you want to have good defense. And CJ has not provided that necessarily at the shortstop position. And it's fine because he's been spectacular at the plate, but at some point, you've got to have a better defender there at shortstop, being, like I said, one of those positions that sometimes, frankly, you've seen teams do this throughout the history of baseball, where if I can have an elite center fielder or I can have an elite shortstop, but they can't hit, I can live with that versus I can't have a shortstop that can hit but can't field. I need to move that guy. And that's kind of where C.J. Abrams falls into right now is one of the best hitters of a middle infielder in Major League Baseball this season, but also one of the worst fielders, not just in the middle infield, but in Major League Baseball, period, by the metrics. So I think for him, moving off of shortstop, I understand why that would be such a difficult pill to swallow. There's a confidence, there's a, I don't mean this in a bad way, but like an arrogance or a aura around being a shortstop. There's something just a distinguishing ability that I'm a shortstop. I mean, you look at a team like the Padres and how many of their guys were former shortstops. That's usually the best player on the field. I mean, you go to high school, college, like, you know, that means something to be a shortstop. And so I understand you're getting moved off that position, it's going to hurt. So this isn't something that you would expect the conversation with CJ to be, hey, you're moving off shortstop, and I'm going, sure thing, man, great. You know, these guys, when they get to a certain level, you have to have a confidence in yourself that borders on arrogance, that borders on, you know, thinking a little bit too much of yourself at times, and that's what it takes to play in professional sports. So I'm not saying he's arrogant or anything of that nature, but he's going to have a confidence in himself that he can get it done, obviously. He believes in himself, and that's totally fine. So that conversation was never going to be easy. But I just wonder about the timing of all of this. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I get the move itself, but I can hear the reasoning of, well, you know, there's not tons to play for the rest of the season, so go ahead and move him over to second base, to which I'd say, well, if there's nothing to play for, then why does it matter now to save a few runs potentially by moving Nassim Nunez to shortstop? Why wouldn't you have done that in June when you were still competing for a playoff spot, or, you know, July when there was legitimate talks about this team being in the wild card discussion? Why wouldn't you consider it then versus now? If your point is you don't want to upset CJ when things are going so well for the team, I can understand that as well. I also just don't think, if you're saying, well, we want to see a little bit more of Nassim Nunez there, I like what Nas has been able to give this team defensively this season and as a base runner, but I don't think he's your long-term answer at shortstop by any means. Obviously, they've got guys in the minor leagues. We could see Seaver King here debut in, you know, the next month or so, and that would be nice to see. He's been on absolute tear in the month of August. I'd love to see him here soon. Maybe he's playing shortstop, but even then, your shortstop of the future was the number one overall pick last year in Eli Willits. So I don't fully understand that perspective. I also am not all that worried if you're thinking, well, CJ needs to play second base. I think he'll pick it up just fine. I think CJ is a great athlete. I think he'll be totally fine at second base the second he steps over there. He's played second base in the big leagues before just for a couple of games with the Padres. So it's not like he's never had experience over there. But regardless, I don't think it's going to be difficult for him to figure out how to play second base. The only argument that I could hear that makes sense to me of sorts would be that, assuming he's going to play for this team next season, because maybe part of it too is if you don't think you're going to keep him and you're going to trade him in the offseason, then the relationship aspect of it isn't as important, which I would just say you got to be a little careful when you operate under that assumption, because if you're not going to get the package that you want, he probably could be playing here on opening day next season, at which point then maybe you miscalculated it if you didn't care about the relationship aspect, which I don't think that's part of the reasoning. But if part of their reasoning is, hey, we want to play him at second base because we realize that that's going to be a major adjustment, that's going to be something that maybe takes a little time for him to accept, and right now there's not a lot to play for, and so I can live with if he goes into a little bit of a slump or if there's a little bit of frustration and he has to get that out, and I deal with that in August of a season that is now not going to end up in a playoff season versus dealing with that in spring training in the first month or two of next season. I could see that being the argument, like, hey, let's just go ahead and rip the Band-Aid off now when this season is kind of gone by the wayside at this point and they're not going to make the playoffs, even though I think it's been a successful season. You know, it's not one that's going to end in a playoff run. So let's go ahead and rip the Band-Aid off now versus potentially having a frustrated shortstop slash, well, now second baseman, you know, to start the season, and maybe it affects his spring training and affects the start of his 2027 season, assuming he's still wearing a Nationals uniform. So that's something that maybe you could consider, but regardless, I think the timing is the only thing I would have an issue with. I don't mind them moving him to second base. I think it makes all the sense in the world. I think he could be a fantastic center fielder as well if they ever wanted to do that, or if another team wanted to do that, if they trade for him. So be interesting to see, but that's been kind of the talk of the Nationals, is CJ Abrams moving to second base. Speaking of that, Spencer Nussbaum, fantastic journalist for beat reporter for The Athletic covering the Nationals. He joined Grant and Danny earlier this week to talk about that move and some conversations he's had with various people around CJ Abrams and around the team about that move. Here was Spencer Nussbaum on Grant and Danny.
Baseball fans, think you know who's hitting a homer today? Well, FanDuel is giving you a free chance to call your shot with daily dingers. Joining the action is easy. Just make your free pick on who's hitting a home run in their game, and if you're right, you'll get a profit boost to use on your next bet for a chance at extra winnings. You've got nothing to lose and a lot to gain. And don't forget, you can make a free pick every day during the MLB season. It's just another reason why FanDuel is the home for home runs. So, are you ready to play your game today? Join all the action at FanDuel.com/podcast. That's FanDuel.com/podcast to play daily dingers and make your free pick on who's hitting a homer. Play ball and swing for the fences on FanDuel, an official partner of the MLB.
Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
So you had a really important story in The Athletic that we went through today, where you caught up with C.J. Abrams' agent as well as Paul Toboni, it sounds like, and those guys talked about the move to second base. It is not a move, from what I gather, that C.J. Abrams was excited about or took all that well, but he's at least playing ball. So educate us on how this transition is going to go.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is still TBD, but you hit the biggest bullet points here. Again, there's 100, you know, threads to pull on when we think about the future of this decision. I think the most important thing is to consider is A, are you keeping CJ happy? And B, how much do you care about keeping CJ happy as it portends to a future either extension or trade? Those are all things, again, we can get into. But some of the on-field considerations, whether it's whether he'll play better at second base, I think that's likely, but not a certainty. Whether it'll affect his hitting, I think it could and already has a little bit, but we'll see. Like all these other things are important, but when we think about the big narrative of the Nationals, I think so much of it is about either a trade or an extension in the coming year.
Why'd they do this now?
Yeah, it's a question I've asked and gotten kind of different answers to. I think the clearest answer that I will say that I believe, I think that's the right way to put it, is they believe that you are getting a good sample to maybe clarify what your offseason in 2027 looks like. So for instance, if you wait until this offseason to say, hey, CJ, you're our second baseman in the future, you don't really get a sample of who he is as a second baseman until, you know, 70 games into next season or whatever it is. By doing this now, you get the sample of, hey, we have these final 25 games or so. And this has not been said explicitly to me, but I think we can read between the lines a little bit here. This is chances for other teams to look at him as a second baseman and see what's possible. And I think beyond that, he's been so poor at shortstop that the timing was never going to be perfect. But I think if you talk to some people around the Nationals, they might tell you that it's an inevitability that he's moving over there. And so I think that's why they did it now.
Spencer Nussbaum of The Athletic discussing CJ Abrams' move to second on Grant and Danny. Does moving him make it more or less likely that he gets traded in 2027?
Yeah, I still don't have a solid answer here to play out, I guess, both sides of the argument. Again, you could say it's an audition for other teams to see him at second base. On the flip side, there's a big downside that his second base defense could be worse than the, you know, mystery box or the question mark. And it still is a relatively small sample of him there. Maybe you read it the other way and you say, hey, like, we want this to be our guy in 2027. We want this to be our second baseman next to Seaver King or Nassim Nunez or whoever it may be, because that's what the models will tell you is going to win you more games. At the same time, then why do you not do it earlier in the season, right? I still think and have thought since last offseason that this upcoming offseason is the most likely time that Abrams will be traded. I just think you look at the timeline of the Nationals, even though it's been moved up, you think about what he might command in a trade. And I just think if I'm the Nationals, I shouldn't say if I'm the Nationals, but I just think that that's the most likely time it happens. And so for me, that's kind of what I would stick with.
Spencer Nussbaum with us here on G&D. Great story about CJ Abrams and his move to second base. So tell me where I'm wrong if you think I am. This to me, like if somebody's having the kind of season he's having offensively, you put up with kind of whatever you have to defensively, and you don't rock the boat. Now that they're eliminated, and I think internally they realize, you know what, we're not signing this dude. Whether ownership won't pay, whether it's the lockout that's coming, whatever, we're not in the long-term business, and we don't care if we ruffle the feathers right now this minute. And so that, to me, kind of signed, sealed, and delivered the FedEx slip that he's out the door this winter at some point, assuming they get a good enough offer. Where am I wrong there, Spencer, or am I?
Yeah, I want to phrase this carefully because this is not reported per se or not right. something that I'm going on record of saying, but I've always felt that a C.J. Abrams extension was highly unlikely, and I think you're exactly right that this is just another case or another detail explaining why it is potentially unlikely, right? Again, you think about the Nationals' payroll and that the fact that they haven't paid players handsomely over the years. You think about what CJ and his agency probably feels that he's worth. You think about the fact that that free agent class has a couple strong options, but CJ might be the one or two in that class. Like you think about all those things. He just strikes me as a player that always maybe would be more likely or maybe smarter to test the open market. And yeah, I think this is just kind of another detail that adds on to the list of reasons why he just feels to me like someone who's unlikely to sign an extension here.
Spencer, I can get down with that and be cool with that if Paul Toboni and his entire staff, the Avengers of the analytics guys from all over baseball, if Ani Colombi comes back and closes the computer and says, I don't want to pay C.J. Abrams. Cool. But if it's just that they don't want to spend on him because it starts with a 2 or something, that doesn't work for me. And I wonder how big of a factor is the second part. Like, why shouldn't they try to extend C.J. Abrams? Now, I'm not saying at $350 million, but 30 homer, 100 RBI, middle infielders don't grow on trees. And it does go back to the very beginning of, I mean, we've been doing this dance since, you know, three writers of at the Post and the Athletic ago. Like, at some point, I'd like to talk to one person that says, the Nats might actually extend this guy. Like, ever? Maybe? I mean, they're not the Athletics. I have no interest in being the Athletics. And I don't want to be the Rays either. I'm happy to be the Rays, but I want to be the Rays with a checkbook.
Correct. You have to spend money at some point. And the case for extending CJ, as you said, is so simple. He is one of those, if not tier 1A, tier 1B, or tier 1C players that you need on a team. And even if you don't think he's your shortstop, fine. Even if you think Eli Willett's coming up is going to be great, fine. I can get on board with that as well. But they have to spend money at some point. And if you're not at least going to make the offer to a guy who, again, has seemed to enjoy playing in D.C., who has improved every season, who has been in that, again, elite class of hitters this season, if that's not someone you're interested in extending, who is, right? And I think ultimately the answer for the Nationals, if it's not CJ, you know, it's probably like a Cade Cavalli or someone on the mound that you really believe in because of how strong your hitting development has been. But you need foundational pieces at a certain point. And so while I would still beat their drum and say that the Nationals trading CJ is not a bad idea per se, I think if you're going to play this out and not extend him, that is a bad idea.
I'm just thinking out loud, and I've given this next to no thought, but I mean, analytic like model organizations don't really pay pitchers or extend pitchers to an extent, do they? I guess the Rays did like a 2-year deal with Rasmussen, but I'm trying to remember if that was like based on arbitration or whatever. That would seem weird to me for them to pay an arm.
No, it is weird. I think that the reason why I bring it up is because they just feel so sound on the position player front that if you give Cade Cavalli another 2 years after arb, then you believe that he's a postseason arm, you lock that up. Again, the reason teams don't do it is obvious. Those guys get injured. It's a big risk. But with the lack of success that the Nationals have had on the mound, that's at least naturally where my mind might initially go. But you're exactly right that like Abrams is more of a sure thing or more of a sure bet that teams that are analytically driven usually take.
Spencer, this I'm trying to figure out how I want to ask this question, but this is generally a compliment to them, but it's just something I've noticed, and you're around the club more than I am. They seem to have been able to, this is Butera and Toboni and everybody under the sun, names that we don't know, they've been able to deliver some pretty bad news to guys and not have it ruffle feathers too often, right? Whether it's sending Cruz down for an extended time, you know, unceremoniously telling Brady House you got to go down and work on something, or, you know, guys getting called up to get kicked in for multiple innings and they're right back down on the farm. they've been able to do that and kind of keep the train on the tracks here. I know they've swooned here a little bit lately, but still way more competitive than we thought they'd be. They've kind of shown a way to be able to do that. This is probably the biggest withdrawal in that kind of space, if that makes any sense, telling CJ things he doesn't really want to hear probably. But I've kind of been amazed that they've been able to walk that line for long enough. Tag, you're it.
Yeah, and that's kind of what makes the timing of this all surprising, is from a communication standpoint, it's far from ideal. But, I mean, this is all stuff that I'm planning on writing before the season is over, right, where I'm hearing from players who have been in other orgs, like, how I was working out next to Paul in the weight room. Like, I've never had a GM, you know, be there and, you know, shoot the you-know-what with me. I've never had a, you know, manager send me down and right when I come back up, you know, instill the sort of confidence in me that I've had. I've, you know, all these sorts of things where it's like, it's not, there is a level of authenticity to it where that group can explain to the players, hey, we're not going to BS you. You know that we're doing this because we think it's in the best interest of the organization. And also, we're going to do everything that we can to get the very best out of you. Like, you look at a Dylan Cruz, even though he hasn't thrived up here, he went down to AAA, and the, you know, hitting coaches that worked down there with him, he fell in love with them. And you think about some of the pitchers that have come here and struggled, Simon Matthews has pumped all the confidence in the world into them. And so, you know, do I have a solid take here about whether the Nationals are like the best communicating org in baseball? Like, I don't know that I can go out and say that. But the strides that they've made on that front compared to what I at least had kind of seen and heard over the previous 2 years is more drastic than I can kind of even cover here.
Check out Spencer's piece. It's an exclusive in The Athletic. CJ Abrams not thrilled with change, agent says, but focus remains on Nationals is the headline, and you can go read the piece now. Spencer, before I let you go, Seaver King's been killing the ball. He's one of the better hitters in the minors since the All-Star break. I want to say he's over 400 in his last 10. They're the opposite of whatever Mike Rizzo was when it comes to calling up prospects. Like, Yo-Yo Morales, you go hit 40 home runs, young man, but you ain't getting to the big leagues. You know what I'm saying? And I know he obviously hasn't been completely healthy in the second half, but I think I was reading one of your pieces recently, and the idea was, like, if he comes up in September, like, they still think he has work to do. What's he got to do? I mean, especially if shortstop's open. Nassim Nunez is a plus defender, and that's great, but there's zero reason in September not to have Seaver King playing short. There's no way that wouldn't happen, right?
Again, I think it's most likely that he'll be up in September. The argument against it, if I'm forced to give it, is the chase rate, while improved, is still high and something that he's shown that he can improve over time, which could help in AAA. And you think about the 40-man considerations heading into the lockout and what that would mean for having him play in minor league games this year, being in contact with the org during the offseason. I guess that'd be the other element to think of if we don't see him up here. But to me, as you explicitly laid out, he just feels like the Nationals shortstop in September. But again, that's not reported. That's just kind of my speculation.
Spencer, great stuff, my friend. Really good work on that article as well, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
That was Spencer Nussbaum on Grant and Danny about CJ Abrams and company. Now let's get into Cade Cavalli. He's been the other story of this team as you've watched over the last week or so, and what he's been able to accomplish in his last couple of times out has been nothing short of spectacular. I mean, you look at what he did in this game against Texas in game two of the series, where he goes six innings, no runs, 11 strikeouts, only threw 84 pitches. Got to think that there was a chance that if they really wanted to push it, he could have gone another inning, but after going over 100-plus pitches the last two outings, maybe they decided, you know, that's something that I would prefer to just avoid. But he's now gone quality starts in his last eight starts. The last time he didn't turn in a quality start was July 5th. He's been on an absolute tear, and now he's working on 14 straight scoreless innings in his last two starts, 21 strikeouts in those 14 innings, giving up just four hits in that time frame, three walks. He's been absolutely impressive, and it's been fun to watch him evolve. It's been fun to see the way that he's grown, and he's an example of a modern pitcher. I was talking about this the other day on The Fan, where he's someone that the fastball, you would think in old school terms, like, all right, he throws 97, can get up to 98, 99. That's someone who's going to live off the fastball. And in reality for Cade, his fastball gets hit at a much higher clip than you would think. And that would be the one knock on him this season. His walk rate has been good. His strikeout rate has been good. But his batting average against is really in the bottom 10, 15% in qualified starters among Major League Baseball, which you would think would be much better than that. And so for him, he's got to find a way to tweak that fastball, I would think, to be able to make it a little bit more effective, because hitters are hitting around 300 on it this season. And you'd like to see that be a little bit more of effective of a pitch. But regardless, he's been able to work off of that fastball where I need to be able to throw it, obviously, to get people off my curveball and my sweeper. But he finds a way to do so in that he still sets up that curveball and sweeper to be that put-away pitch, to be the difference maker. He threw a pitch to, I'm trying to remember exactly which hitter it was for the Rangers, but he threw a front door sweeper to ring him up. And it, I don't know how you do anything against that pitch. It starts inside the right-handed batter's box and breaks over the front corner of the plate. I don't know what you're supposed to do. And the way that his breaking ball was breaking against Texas, the way that it was breaking against Chicago, I mean, some of the looks on Chicago's hitters, Pete Crow Armstrong, I mentioned on the last pod, the way he would peer out at the mound, like, what the heck was that, dude? And you saw a little bit of that with the Rangers, where I was like, all right, I'm going to go sit down. I didn't have a chance there. So for him to be able to get to that point in his career has been really, really impressive, and it's been fun to watch. And with the injuries that he's had, to now make 27 starts, tied for the major league lead in terms of most starts this season, that's impressive. He's out there every fifth day. He's been so important to this team, and over these last month and a half, 2 months, he's really taken that next step where he looks like he can be not just a middle of the rotation or even frontline type of starter. Like, this is an ace type of starter, the way that he's pitched recently. And I don't think that this is something that's a fluke. I think that the potential is there, and now you're starting to see him realize it. Early in the season, you had to remember that this is a guy that hadn't pitched a full major league season. He was still getting some of that experience at the major league level, still growing into what he can be as a major leaguer. So been really cool to see him grow and been ultra impressive to watch. And I'm excited to see what he can do to finish out the season. And I'm just glad that he's been able to be healthy and take that next step. I think that means a lot. I reference this a lot, but I had a conversation with him a couple of weeks ago. It was on a few episodes ago, if you want to check that out. One of my favorite baseball conversations I've had, just talking about some pitching philosophy and different things, and I thought it was really insightful. Really good guy, really easy to root for, and I think what he's been able to turn in recently, I think it just shows you that that ability on the mound, it's there, and now he's being able to put everything together and turn into one of the better starters in the National League over the last month or so. Speaking of which, Simon Matthews, the pitching coach of the Washington Nationals, has been a big part of helping Cade Cavalli take that next step in his career. He joined Grant and Danny to talk about Cade Cavalli and his success and what he's seen, as well as other pitchers on the Nats staff and even down to the minor leagues. Here was Simon Matthews with Grant and Danny.
Bang, zoom. But Simon, thanks for a few minutes here on G&D. How are you?
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me.
Always a pleasure, buddy. Let's talk Cade Cavalli's just growth here. I mean, he really truly is starting to look like a number one. When you see a guy on this kind of run, 10 quality starts in 11, the strikeout totals piling up, what is he doing better of late?
I think he's just been really mature all year about sort of biting off one thing at a time and trying to really dominate, you know, the next step in his progression, the next step in his development. For a little while there, that was right. Like, he wasn't getting through bulk innings all the time, every time out. And as our number one, especially early on in the year, like as we were figuring out how things were going to go, right? Like, figuring out how to be a little bit more efficient, get through bulk innings. And then, you know, he started navigating kind of a larger arsenal, right? Figuring out really what is he was going to use each one of his pitches. And of late, recently, it's just been about coming out and making sure that he takes control of the energy of the game. I think a couple weeks ago when we played the Blue Jays at home and Max Scherzer had that outing where, you know, he didn't go deep in the game, but, you know, come hell or high water, he wasn't giving it up to us. There was a way he controlled the energy of that game. I think that was really strong for Cade to watch that and how he went about that. And figure out, you know, in the context of what it is he does and what it is he does well, how he can be that guy for us.
I'm going to throw Simon on hold, and Darius is going to try to work out whatever's going on with the phone. But I think that's a really good observation,
yeah.
Which is, we've talked about this, the difference sometimes in the stuffy, really talented young arms that can throw the ball past people and the really quality pitcher who's a frontline type starter is on that day when you don't have your best stuff, being able to figure it out and go hang six innings.
Well, even beyond that, what do you do well? And he throws 97 miles an hour. That's what his average fastball is. And yet, his fastball gets hit just when if he tries to throw it by people. And that's what I want to ask Simon Matthews about here in a moment, is to figure that part of it out.
Yeah, but he's back, so ask him.
Yeah, so Simon, for someone with that kind of an arm, talking about Cavalli and his average fastball is around 97 miles an hour, obviously that's not the issue, but that fastball gets hit relative to his other offerings, and he's been pinpoint in terms of tunneling and kind of mixing and matching. But I want you to piggyback off your previous answer where you're talking about what he does well. It seems like he's leaning into things that aren't his fastball, and now that fastball's turned more into a weapon here of late. I'd love for you to speak to that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Right, like velocity in today's game is kind of more necessary, it's the beginning of your ticket to the dance than anything else, right? And so he's got that elite velocity, but it's not elite velocity just itself that makes the overpowering fastball. And he's done a lot of really diligent work to improve the movement, especially on his four seam fastball. He's getting the hang of some grip adjustments he's made over the course of the year with the sinker to be more consistent with that pitch, right? But like the thing that makes Cade Cavalli special is those two breaking balls and the ability to throw those. And so, you know, if that's going to be what makes him special, that's what he's going to go down fighting with. And I think he's made that conscious decision to use those two pitches really aggressively, to combo them off of each other. And then it's caused the fastball, like you said, to start playing up along with a lot of the work he's done to continue to improve the quality of that fastball.
Yeah, to that point, just to dive into the numbers a little bit and to get a little deeper into that, it's interesting because his four-seamer, which he throws a lot more to lefties, but especially against lefties, still gets hit at a rate that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I know his expected batting average is like 255 compared to the actual batting average, which is closer to 300. But his stuff, throwing around 97, and maybe it's more a shape of a pitch thing or whatever. Like, I remember in AAA watching him sometimes, and he'd have a start where he strikes out 5 or 6, and you're like, how's that not 9 or 10 with that stuff? And he's starting to do that. But it is odd to me that the fastball has gotten hit by lefties to the extent that it has. What's the difference between days where that's not happening and days where it is?
A lot of times it's just the fine-tuning of command and location. Right. If he's going to have a really good day, he's going to get his height right with his fastball. So if he's going down, it's down. If he's going up, it's up. But I mean, this league can hit velocity right now, man. It's really impressive. Some of the work that even, you know, the 6, 7, 8 hitters in every lineup, 9 hitters in every lineup, like they can all hit a fastball, man. And so, If that's gonna be the way things are, then Cade, when he's really good with the heater, especially getting his height right, then it can be an overpowering pitch. And then on the days when the height's not quite right, which have been fewer and farther between as of late, then you know he's gonna be in business a little bit because it adds another thing that he can get guys to miss.
Nats pitching coach Simon Matthews, kind enough to join us here on G&D. So, I mean, it's not like I'm taking this for granted, Simon. This has been unbelievable and awesome. It's a treat to watch. But you can't help but wonder, for a guy that doesn't have a million big league innings, what's next? Like, is there more growth in the tank for this guy who's just turned into a stud here in the second half especially?
I think so. I think anybody who's spent some time around Cade, there's just a there's a real seriousness about him just as a man, as a human being, that, you know, reminds me of some of the really great pitchers I've been around, reminds, you know, Sean Doolittle and Bobby Wilson on our staff that have been around some unbelievable arms. Sean was one himself, just like of what it takes to do this year in and year out. I don't want to take for granted just how difficult it is to put together one really good year, let alone two, three, four. But if there's a human being, if there's a man that's capable of deciding to put in that work and then doing it, it's Cade. So I'm going to bet on that guy. And I believe in him, you know, continuing to take steps forward.
Simon Matthews, pitching coach with the Nationals, joining us here on Grant and Danny, talking Cade Cavalli, who's just been unbelievable.
Lights out.
Breaking run value is 97th percentile. Fastball velocity right now in the sport, 83rd percentile, and he's got a great ground ball rate. Strikeout rate's over 80th percentile. If you wouldn't mind, let's talk Will Dion for a second. I'm really intrigued by him because, you know, I look at velocity first a lot of the times, and then I can kind of get into some of the metrics on movement and whatnot, and I'm not an expert like you guys are. But coming over, I'm like, okay, it's okay, big league stuff. But then you see his release and like how over the top he is, and there's a funkiness to him that I can't really explain watching him. Now, I'm not expecting him to only give up one hit every nine innings like he has, nine strikeouts. Like, he has been, I mean, he's thrown a no-hitter basically for you guys. Mizorowski. But how is he so effective? I mean, he's pretty much like 91 to 93, right?
Yeah, no, he's you're definitely right with the funkiness. And I think he leans into it. It's just a weird angle for a good fastball that's got plus carry to it. He throws that kind of parachute style changeup that not a ton of guys in the league throw. And so it's kind of a perfect storm of him just being a complete weirdo that that he leans into, and it's been good for us.
I love that. But just getting to that about trying to maximize what everybody does, right? So he's leaning into being, as you said, a weirdo with a parachute changeup, et cetera. In terms of your core philosophies versus what each guy maybe does well, how do you balance that as a pitching coach to kind of make each guy to turn the faders up to maximum on each player?
Yeah, I think there's a reason why everybody's here, right? And so trying to be quick to understand what the sort of baseline reason why everybody's here is, right? So for Will, it's that fastball changeup combo, right? So we need to protect that with our life, right? He's got to be protective of that fastball shape, of his delivery and how he gets to it, and that changeup and his ability to kill velocity on it and execute it to both-sided hitters. And then beyond that, from a developmental standpoint, it's like, okay, what's a little seasoning we can put on this mix to get him to have even more success, right? So if you go to the butcher shop and buy a beautiful cut of meat, you're not going to immediately like chop it up into little pieces, right? You're going to put some seasoning on it, and you're going to try and put that beautiful cut of meat into a position to become a beautiful grilled steak, right? So I think that's ultimately what we're after, right? Like, what is it about this guy that makes him special, right? And then how can we add something here, tweak something there, while preserving the things that are sort of innate to him, and have him continue to grow and have more success in the big leagues?
This is my happy place, Danny.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when it's all over for me, they're just like, hey, where do you want to go back to? It's not going to be, like, you know, in the yard with the kids or something. It's going to be, like, that time Simon Matthews was comparing steak to, like, deep-dive baseball.
To, like, pitching repertoire.
Analytics, yeah. I know you're busy, and you're not following the minors with, like, Ben Grable, Joe Glass, Jack Siebert, and Josh Hartle and those guys. But I am curious, actually, now that we're talking about Dion. When these trades happen, do they have you watch tape on any of these guys or like get your opinion on their stuff or anything? Or because you're the big league pitching coach, are you kind of out of that portion of it?
No, absolutely. I think one of the real strengths of this group as we're building it out is some of the relationships that we're able to build just personally between the guys that are, you know, boots on the ground running that day to day and, you know, me as a big league pitching coach, right? So you've got Grayson Crawford, the director of pitching. He and I are super tight. We talk every day. And Devin Pearson and Justin Horowitz, two of our assistant general managers, who were super involved with the trade deadline, as well as obviously Ani and Paul. We're all in constant communication. And those guys, just as much as me, I hope it comes through, like, we all just love ball, man. So when we get a guy like a Joe Glassie is a great example, right? Devin Pearson's texting me like, hey, you got to pull up the video of Joe Glassie's first outing. It was unbelievable, right? And so we're all just like getting excited about doing this together. And you know, as our group grows and as our system improves and as we acquire some of the big pieces of the future, right? Like we're all just, you know, sitting around the conference table prepping for the Rangers, but also getting fired up about the, you know, Ben Grable punching out four in one inning in his first inning in Double A with us, right? Like it's kind of all the same thing to us, right? Like it's all the same work. It's all stuff that we're constantly talking about, and it's been a blast to do it with these guys.
Yeah, Nats fans may not know because they're in the minors, but that group of arms, Grable, Glassie, Siebert, Hartle, who are some of the top guys you guys bring over at the deadline, 29 2/3 innings and just 3 earnings in the minors so far. And the two future relievers may be in leverage spots, Grable and Glassie, who have crazy minor league numbers. 10 scoreless innings with a .5 whip so far and 13.5 strikeouts per 9. So it's been really exciting. Those are all guys that aren't like in single A. They could impact the team next year. Simon Matthews is with us on Grant and Danny. We were talking about the breakout of Cade Cavalli here. On Brad Lord, he came up as a starter, was an org pitcher the year before you were here, former 18th round pick, kind of came into his own early this season, it felt like, as a multi-inning reliever, and now he's back almost out of necessity, maybe kind of as the bulk guy starting games. Do you think, when we fast forward a couple years, like where is he best?
I don't know if I can answer that necessarily. I think when Blake and I had the conversation about sliding Brad into the rotation, you know, as you said, in some ways out of necessity, Blake put it, I think, in a great way where he's just like, I just think Brad's really good, so I want him to pitch. So if that's in the rotation, I want Brad to pitch in the rotation. If that's bulk out of the pen, I want Brad to pitch bulk out of the pen. I really believe in Brad's stuff. I believe in his ability to compete at this level. So, I think ultimately Brad's gonna fall into his best role as our roster evolves over the next couple of years. But you know, he's something, whether it's announcing the starters for a series or calling down to the bullpen, he's somebody we're really excited to put in the game.
Simon, tell me about Jackson Kent. I'm a Jackson Kent guy. It's early, small sample, but it looks like a couple times maybe games, you know, sped up a little bit, lost the zone, more walks than you're kind of used to seeing from him. But I really like the profile. I'm much older than you. I like big 6'3", 220-pound pitchers. Like it would look like a tight end room for me on my
Absolutely.
Staff. I'm a Jackson Kent guy. What have you seen?
Yeah, no, he's the real deal, and he's going to be fine. I think a lot of the conversations that he and I have had over the course of the last, you know, week, 10 days is, you know, it's gone fine for stretches up here and it's gone less than fine for short stretches up here. But all the things that are between it going fine and it going really good are things that he's already done really well in his career, right? He controls the strike zone really well. You know, he's not going to be the guy that walks a ton of guys, right? Like he got beat by what, 6 ground ball singles, here a couple days ago in Texas. Right. And so, you know, you clean up a couple things execution wise, and start to learn the league. And I think he's going to be really good, but I'm with you, man. Just not only looking at our staff now, but looking at our group in the minor leagues, I think we're getting close to that tight end room. I joke that we're going to lead the league at getting off the bus.
All get off the bus team, Simon.
It's the biggest pitching staff ever. I mean, we were in the clubhouse. This was even last year before you guys were here. And like some of these dudes, and some of them aren't even around, but like you had to be 6'6 to be in the minor league side of your camp. It was wild how big the staff is. And I know the game's changing to an extent. But, and that's everywhere. But.
Like, I want that little tiny fracas. Hopefully no punches, though, no suspensions. But bench is clear. Bullpen comes running in, and you notice our bullpen. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's
Absolutely.
Big. Yeah, that's what I like.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You mentioned...
We joked in Colorado when we got into the little scrum that Eddie Yeam got there the next day, and they were lucky they got it in the day before he got there.
Purposeful.
Well, I was just at a Commanders training camp, and they're down a couple D tackles right now. So if Eddie Jean's got nothing going on, they could probably use him.
He probably needs 2 or 3 weeks to learn the rules, and then he'd be fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Seriously.
Stuff-wise, you guys were one of the only bullpens. I saw a stat a few weeks ago, and this no longer qualifies, but there were like 78 relievers this year that were averaging 98 and change out of the bullpen, mm-hmm. and you guys didn't have any of them. And now you've added, obviously, a couple guys who do throw really, really hard. You just sent one down who's got to learn to throw some strikes. But I'm wondering about Luis Perales now coming out of the pen mm-hmm. the last couple times. He had a two-inning outing where he struck out three. And, I mean, it was like just absolutely bite-your-knuckles stuff the other night where he struck out five and had a 90% whiff rate on the splitter. Is that a role we could see him in this season, do you think? And what do you make of his stuff? Because he's kind of had a... I don't want to say a disappointing season, but I've been a little surprised by some of the numbers this year.
I'm an absolute Luis Perales believer. I think he's a killer. I think the stuff is obviously unbelievable. Jump off the page at you. I mean, you know, I don't pretend to know exactly what we're going to do with him over the course of the next 5-6 weeks. Like, what I can tell you is, like, we're going to make sure we get this one right, because when we get this thing really rolling, Luis Perales is going to be running out of our bullpen to punch tickets. Right. So like, he's on a bit of a heater right now. And you know, hopefully he can, stay consistent with that, because you know, that stuff's going to work. It's going to work in this league. It's going to work in the next league. You know what I mean? Yeah, I just, I'd love to see him up here at some point. I don't pretend to know exactly how that's going to play out, but I'll tell you right now, that kid's going to be punching tickets for the Nationals and the big leagues for a while in the future.
Yeah, I can't wait. We saw him in spring training. It was actually funny. So Paul was sitting in the booth with us doing an interview with us, and it was the first time he'd pitched. It was like March 3rd or something like that in a spring game, and we had just gotten to West Palm. And Paul was like moving around and like nervous like a dad. And I'm like, are you?
Oh, yeah.
I was like, do you watch every game like this? He's like, no, but I told him not to throw it this hard. And he was like, he was literally
he was rocking.
Throwing like 102.
He was going full Leo Mazzoni on it, dude. He was so upset.
It was like March 3rd. And I was like, oh my, like Paul's not going to make it 162 games. He's like, this is not normal. Like, this is my first, he had just traded for this guy, you know, but it was,
right.
It was hilarious to watch
no,
that.
No, that's Paul to a T too. If he's got a guy he's particularly fixated on, he is going to watch every bat of his eyelashes and track every step he takes around the mound. And then he's going to have thoughts after, and those thoughts are going to be right. It's been awesome to work with him.
That's cool. So Danny, before we let Simon Matthews go, see, you sleep a little bit on when he was actually pitching. So how about an 8 shutout inning performance at the Cape against a lineup that had Cal Raleigh, Ernie Clement, Jonathan India? I think you were you on the same team or pitching against Tom Cosgrove for that game?
I was on the same team as Tom Cosgrove, yeah. The Chatham A's.
Chatham.
Back in my glory days. That's
Let's
the last
go.
Day I was any good.
I mean, that one, has Cosgrove heard about that?
I'd hang my hat.
I'll bet he probably has brought it up to you even. I mean, that's pretty nasty.
When he got here, I was joking around that he's one of the only people who might actually remember that I used to be any good.
Well, you know what's such a bummer is you never got to play on the on-field campus at Georgetown, where you would hit a ball 500 feet and you had to go another 15 feet to that little mini graveyard where Mo Vaughn hit his.
Right. Yeah, no, that's they've done a beautiful job with that campus, but I every time I used to walk past the business school, I would think about it used to be in a ball field and, you know, be a little bit bummed out.
It's a great parking lot now for the hospital. I mean, it really is a good parking lot.
There you go.
What's your level of Knicks fandom? Charlie Slows told me, like, during the playoffs, you were ride or die with the Knicks.
Yeah, I grew up a gigantic Knicks fan, through, you know, those, like, late 90s, early 2000s teams with Latrell Sprewell and Allen Houston. And then my dad and I used to go to a couple games a year when Eddie Curry was, like, the quickest dunker of all time. And Isaiah Thomas was running the show. And as I've gotten into this job, it's really hard for me to end the day getting my heart broken by a loss that's not a Nationals loss or make my day with a win that's not a Nationals win, right? I already end the day 162 times a year, like either as a winner or a loser. So in the off season, I kind of need to take a deep breath, but the Knicks run was unbelievable. They hauled me all the way back in, and Charlie and I were sitting at the bar in Cleveland when they clinched because we were playing the Guardians. We watched them clinched, and I just sat there kind of soaking it up. It was a blast. It was a really fun run.
That's awesome.
That must be really cool to have your team win a championship. That is something we all want to have again. Simon, appreciate
That's
you, buddy.
Exactly right.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, man. Keep up the great work.
Yeah. Thanks. Take care, guys.
I tell you what, Simon Matthews could sell you on anybody, right? I mean, just listen to him talk about Luis Perales and some of the other guys. I'm really excited to see what this staff is able to do. And I think, Simon and his staff, that's still the big question for the Nationals. The hitting has come around. You've seen it at the major league level. You're seeing it at the minor league level. The question then becomes the pitching side of things. Paul Taboni opted to flood the system with pitchers at the deadline by trading away some of the assets for just a boatload of pitchers. Now it's about developing those guys, and you're seeing some of those guys pitch at the major league level. You've seen Yovani Cruz. He struggled. He went back down to AAA, but you've seen Cruz. You've seen Will Dion. You've seen Jake Bird. Jake Bird, less of a prospect long-term option, but still someone that's pitched at the major league level. But that's maybe not even getting to the best arms that were acquired at the deadline with Graybull and Siebert and those guys. So excited to see how they develop those. And that's still the major question, is where are they going to find the pitching? Because it seems like the hitting is going to get replenished. Even if they move off of C.J. Abrams, Eli Willett shouldn't be into the too distant future, and Seaver King's down the line, Devin Fitzgerald, run through the minor leagues there of some of the top hitters in the system. The question becomes the pitching and if they're going to be able to develop that pitching or find that pitching internally. And so that'll be interesting to see, but it's easy to see why Simon Matthews, someone as smart as him, got the gig that he has. And now it's about being able to develop some of these guys. And you've seen some development from guys at the major league level. So hopefully it's something that, going forward, this team can continue to have some of the success that we've seen from this season. All right, that's going to do it for Bustin' Loose Baseball. Appreciate you checking us out. We'll be back after the series coming up to break it all down. Want to get into what we're looking for the final month or so. Marlins series, this is a team that is still fighting for a playoff spot. The Marlins right at 500, the Nats coming in 7 games under. The Nats pretty much out of playoff contention, but still stuff to play for. And for a lot of these guys, a chance to finish out their first, second, third year in the major leagues strong and prove for themselves or even prove to people around Major League Baseball, what they can do. So still a big month and a half left here for the Nationals, and we'll have you covered with it right here on Bustin' Loose Baseball. For producer Darris Tammer, and I'm Toby Altizer, saying thanks for listening. We'll be back after the Marlins series. Until then, enjoy Nats Baseball.